Gulliver's Travels, Part 2, Chapter 8. The king and queen make a progress to the frontiers. The author attends them. The manner in which he leaves the country very particularly related. He returns to England. I always had a strong impulse that I should sometime recover my liberty, though it was impossible to conjecture by what means or to form any project with the least hope of succeeding. The ship in which I sailed was the first ever known to be driven within sight of that coast, and the king had given strict orders that if at any other time it appeared, it should be taken ashore and with all its crew and passengers brought into a tumbril into Lorburgund. He was strongly bent to get me a woman of my own size by whom I might propagate the breed, but I think I should rather have died than undergone the disgrace of leaving a posterity to be kept in cages like tame canary birds, and perhaps in time sold about the kingdom to persons of quality for curiosities. I was indeed treated with much kindness. I was the favourite of a great king and queen, and the light of a whole court, but was upon such a foot as ill became the dignity of humankind. I could never forget those domestic pledges I left behind me. I wanted to be among people with whom I could converse upon even terms, and walk about the streets and fields without being afraid to be trod to death like a frog or young puppy. But my deliverance came sooner than I expected, and in a manner not very common, the whole story and circumstances of which I shall faithfully relate. I had now been 2 years in this country. About the beginning of the third, Glumdalclinch and I attended the king and queen in a progress to the south coast of the kingdom. I was carried, as usual, in my travelling box, which, as I have already described, was a very convenient closet, 12 feet wide, and I had ordered a hammock to be fixed by silken ropes from four corners at the top, to break the jolts when a servant carried me before him on horseback. As I sometimes desired, I would often sleep in my hammock while we were upon the road. On the roof of my closet, not directly over the middle of the hammock, I ordered the joiner to cut a hole of a foot square to give me air in hot weather as I slept, which hole I shut at pleasure with a board that drew backward and forward through a groove. When we came to our journey's end, the king thought proper to pass a few days at a palace he has near Flafisnik, a city within 18 English miles of the seaside. Glumdalclitch and I were much fatigued, and I had gotten a small cold, but the poor girl was so ill as to be confined to her chamber. I longed to see the ocean, which must be the only scene of my escape if it should ever happen. I pretended to be worse than I really was, and desired to take the fresh air of the sea with a page whom I was very fond of and who had sometimes been trusted with me. I shall never forget with what unwillingness Glumdalclitch consented, nor the strict charge she gave the page to be careful of me, bursting at the same time into a flood of tears as if she had some foreboding of what was to happen. The boy took me out in my box about a half hour's walk from the palace towards the rocks on the seashore. I ordered him to set me down, and lifting up one of my sashes, cast many a wistful, melancholy look towards the sea. I found myself not very well, and told the page I had in mind to take a nap in my hammock, which I hoped would do me good. I got in, and the boy shut the window close down to keep out the cold. I soon fell asleep, and all I can conjecture is, while I slept, the page, thinking no danger could happen, went amongst the rocks to look for birds' eggs, having before observed him from my window searching about and picking up one or two in the clefts. Be that as it will, I found myself suddenly awake with a violent pull upon the ring which was fastened at the top of my box for the conveniency of carriage. I felt my box raised very high in the air, then borne forward with prodigious speed. The first jolt had like to have shaken me out of my hammock, but afterwards the motion was easy enough. I called out several times, as loud as I could raise my voice, but all to no purpose. I looked towards my windows and could see nothing but the clouds and sky. I heard a noise just over my head, like the clapping of wings, and then began to perceive the woeful condition I was in. That some eagle had gotten the ring of my box in its beak, with an intent to let it fall on the rock like a tortoise in a shell, and then pick out my body and devour it. For the sagacity and the smell of the bird enables him to discover his quarry at a great distance, though better concealed than I could be within a 2-inch board. In a little time I observed the noise and flutter of its wings to increase very fast, and my box was tossed up and down like a sign in a windy day. I heard several bangs or buffets, and I thought given to the eagle for I am certain it must have been that held the ring of my box in his beak, and then, all of a sudden, felt myself falling perpendicularly down for just above a minute, but with such incredible swiftness that I almost lost my breath. My fall was stopped by a terrible squash that sounded louder to my ears than the cataract of Niagara, after which I was quite in the dark for another minute, and then my box began to rise so high that I could see light from the tops of the windows. I now perceived I was fallen into the sea, my box. By the weight of my body, the goods that were in it, and the broad plates of iron fixed for strength at the four corners of top and bottom, floated about 5 feet deep in water. I did then, and do now suppose, that the eagle which flew away with my box was pursued by 2 or 3 others, and forced to let me drop while he defended himself against the rest, who hoped to share in the prey. The plates of iron fastened at the bottom of the box, for those were the strongest, preserved the balance while it fell and hindered it from being broken on the surface of the water. Every joint of it was well grooved, and the door did not move on hinges, but up and down like a sash, which kept my closet so tight that very little water came in. I got with much difficulty out of my hammock, having first ventured to draw back the slipboard on the roof already mentioned, contrived on purpose to let in air, for want of which I found myself almost stifled. How often did I then wish myself with my dear Glumdalclitch, from whom one single hour had so far divided me. And I may say with truth that in the midst of my own misfortunes I could not forbear lamenting my poor nurse, the grief she would suffer for my loss, the displeasure of the queen, and the ruin of her fortune. Perhaps many travellers have not been under greater difficulties and distress than I was at this juncture, expecting every moment to see my box dashed to pieces, or at least overset by the first violent blast or rising wave. A breach in one single pane of glass would have been an immediate death, nor could anything have preserved the windows. But the strong lattice wires placed on the outside against accidents in travelling, I saw the water ooze in its several crannies. Though the leaks were not considerable, and I endeavoured to stop them as well as I could, I was not able to lift up the roof of my closet, which otherwise I certainly should have done and sat on top of it, where I might at least preserve myself some hours longer, than being shut up, as I may call it, in the hold. Or if I escaped the dangers for a day or two, what could I expect but a miserable death of cold and hunger? I was 4 hours under these circumstances, expecting and indeed wishing every moment to be my last. I have already told the reader that there are 2 strong staples fixed upon the side of my box which had no window, and into which the servant, who used to carry me on horseback, would put a leathern belt and buckle it about his waist. Being in this disconsolate state, I heard, or at least I thought I heard, some kind of grating noise on the side of my box where the staples were fixed. And soon after I began to fancy that the box was pulled or towed along the sea, for now and then felt a sort of tugging which made the waves rise near the top of my windows, leaving me almost in the dark. This gave me some faint hopes of relief, although I was not able to imagine how it would be brought about. I ventured to unscrew one of my chairs, which was always fastened to the floor, and having made a hard shift to screw it down again, directly under the slipping board that I had lately opened, I mounted on the chair, and putting my mouth as near as I could to the hole, I called for help in a loud voice, and in all the languages I understood. I then fastened my handkerchief to a stick I usually carried, and thrusting it up the hole, waved it several times in the air, that if any boat or ship were near, the seamen might conjecture some unhappy mortal be shut up in the box. I found no effect from all I could do, but plainly perceived my closet to be moved along, and in the space of an hour or better, that side of the box where the staples were, and had no windows, struck against something that was hard. I apprehended it to be a rock, and found myself tossed more than ever. I plainly heard a noise upon the cover of my closet, like that of a cable and the grating of it as it passed through the ring. I then found myself hoisted up by degrees, at least 3 feet higher than I was before. Whereupon I thrust up my stick and handkerchief, calling for help till I was almost hoarse, and returned to which I heard a great shout repeated 3 times, giving me such transports of joy that are not to be conceived by those who feel them. I now heard a trampling over my head, somebody calling through the hole in a loud voice and in the English tongue, "If there be anybody below, let them speak." I answered, "I was an Englishman drawn by ill fortune of the greatest calamity that any ever creature ever went, and begged by all that was moving to be delivered out of this dungeon I was in." The voice replied, "I was safe, for my box was fastened to their ship, and the carpenter should immediately come and saw a hole in the cover, large enough to pull me out." I answered, "That was needless, and would take up too much time, for there was no more to be done, but let one of his crew put his finger into the ring and take the box out of the sea into the ship, and so into the captain's cabin." Some of them, upon hearing me talk so wildly, thought I was mad. Others laughed, for indeed it never came into my head that I was now among people of my own stature and strength. The carpenter came, and in a few minutes sawed a passage of about 4 feet square, then let down a small ladder upon which I mounted, and thence was taken into the ship in a very weak condition. The sailors were all in amazement, and asked me 1,000 questions which I had no inclination to answer. I was equally confounded at the sight of so many pygmies, for I took them to be, for after having so long accustomed mine eyes to the monstrous objects I had left. But the captain, Mr. Thomas Wilcox, an honest, worthy Shropshire man, observing I was ready to faint, took me into his cabin, gave me a cordial to comfort me, and made me turn in upon his own bed, advising me to take a little rest, of which I had great need. Before I went to sleep, I gave him to understand that I had some valuable furniture in my box, too good to be lost, a fine hammock, a handsome field bed, 2 chairs, a table, and a cabinet, that my closet was hung on all sides, or rather quilted with silk and cotton, that if he would let one of his crew bring my closet into his cabin, I would open it there before him, show him my goods. The captain, hearing me utter these absurdities, concluded I was raving, however, I suppose to pacify me. He promised to give order as I desired, and going upon deck, sent some of his men down into my closet, whence, as I afterward found, that they drew up all my goods and stripped off the quilting, but the chairs, cabinet, and bedstead being screwed to the fore were much damaged by the ignorance of some seamen, who tore them up by force. They then knocked off some of the boards for use on the ship, and when they gotten all they had mind for, they let the hull drop into the sea, by reason of many breaches made into the bottom of the sides, sunk to rights. And, indeed, I was glad not to have been a spectator of the havoc they made, because I am confident it would have sensibly touched me by bringing my former passages into mind, which I would have rather forgot. I slept some hours, but perpetually disturbed with dreams of the place I had left, and the dangers I had escaped. Whereon, upon walking, I found myself much recovered. It was now about 8 o'clock at night, and the captain ordered supper immediately, thinking I had already fasted too long. He entertained me with great kindness, observing me not to look so wildly or talk inconsistently, and when we were left alone, desired I would give him a relation of my travels, and by what accident I came to be set adrift in that monstrous wooden chest. He said that, about 12 o'clock at noon, he was looking through his glass. He spied it at a distance, and thought it was a sail, which he had a mind to make, being not much out of his course, in hopes of buying some biscuit, his own beginning to fall short. That upon coming near and finding his error, he sent out his longboat to discover what it was. That his men came back in a fright, swearing they had seen a swimming house. That he laughed at their folly and went himself in the boat, ordering his men to take a strong cable along with them. That the weather was being calm, he rowed round me several times, observing my windows and wire lattices that defended them. That he discovered 2 staples upon one side, which was of all boards, without any passage for light. He then commanded his men to row up to that side, fastening a cable to one of the staples. He ordered them to tow my chest, as they call it, toward the ship. When it was there, he gave directions to fasten another cable to the ring fixed in the cover, and to raise up at my chest with pulleys, which all sailors were not able to do above 2 or 3 feet. He said they saw my stick and handkerchief thrust out of the hole, and concluded some unhappy man must be shut up in the cavity. I asked whether he or the crew had seen any prodigious birds in the air. About the time he first discovered me, to which he answered that, discoursing this matter with sailors while I was asleep, one of them said he observed 3 eagles flying towards the north, but remarked nothing of their being larger than usual size, which I suppose must be imputed to the great height at which they were at, and he could not guess the reason of my question. I then asked the captain how far he reckoned we might be from land. He said, by the best computation he could make, we were at least 100 leagues. I assured him that he must be mistaken by almost half, for I had not left the country whence I came above 2 hours before I dropped into the sea. Whereupon he began to think that my brain was disturbed, of which he gave me a hint, and advised me to go to bed in a cabin he provided. I assured him I was well refreshed with his good entertainment and company, and as much as my senses as ever I was in my life. He then grew serious, and desired to ask me freely whether I were not troubled in my mind by the consciousness of some enormous crime for which I was punished, at the command of some prince, by exposing me in my chest, as great criminals in other countries have been forced out to sea in a leaky vessel, without provisions. For although he should be sorry to have taken so ill a man into his ship, yet he would engage his word to set me safe ashore, in the first port where we arrived. He added that his suspicions were much increased by some very absurd speeches I had delivered at first to his sailors, and afterwards to himself, in relation to my closet or chest, as well as by my odd looks and behaviour while I was at supper. I begged his patience to hear me tell my story, which I faithfully did, from the last time I left England to the moment he discovered me. And as truth always forces its way into rational minds, so this honest, worthy gentleman, who had some tincture of learning and very good sense, was immediately convinced of my candour and veracity. But further to confirm all I had said, I entreated him to give order that my cabinet should be brought, of which I had the key in my pocket, for he had already informed me of how the seamen disposed of my closet. I opened it in his own presence and showed him all the small collection of rarities I made in the country from which I had been so strangely delivered. There was the comb I had contrived out of stumps of the king's beard, and another of the same materials, but fixed into a paring of Her Majesty's thumbnail, which served for the back. There was a collection of needles and pins from 1.5 feet to 1 yard long, 4 wasp stings like jaundice tacks, some combings of the queen's hair, a gold ring, which one day she made me a present of in the most obliging manner, taking it from her little finger and throwing it over my head like a collar. I desired the captain would please accept the ring in return for his civilities, which he absolutely refused. I showed him a corn that I had cut off with my own hand from a maid of honour's toe. It was about the bigness of a Kentish pippin, and grown so hard that when I returned to England, I got it hollowed into a cup and set it silver. Lastly, I desired him to see the breeches I had then on, which were then made of a mouse's skin. I could force nothing on him but a footman's tooth, which I observed to him to examine with great curiosity, and found he had a fancy for it. He received it with an abundance of thanks, more than such a trifle could deserve. It was drawn by an unskillful surgeon, in a mistake, from one of the Glumbleclitch's men, who was afflicted with a toothache. But it was as sound as any is in head. I got it clean, put it into my cabinet. It was about a foot long and 4 inches in diameter. The captain was very well satisfied with this plain relation I had given him, and said he hoped when we returned to England I would oblige the wood by putting it on the paper and making it public. My answer was that we were overstocked with books of travels, that nothing now could pass which was not extraordinary, wherein I doubted some authors less consulted truth than their own vanity or interest, or the diversion of ignorant readers, that my story could contain little besides common events, without those ornamental descriptions of strange plants, bees, trees, birds, and other animals, or of the barbarous customs and idolatry of savage people, with which most writers abound. However, I thanked him for his good opinion, and promised to take the matter into my thoughts. He said he wondered at one thing very much, which was to hear me speak so loud, asking me whether the king or queen of that country was thick of hearing. I told him it was what I had been used to for above 2 years past, and that I admired as much as the voices of him and his men, who seemed to be only to whisper, and yet I could hear them well enough. But when I spoke in that country, it was like a man talking in the streets to another looking out from the top of a steeple. Unless when I was placed on a table or held in any person's hands, I told him, I had likewise observed another thing, that when I first got into the ship, the sailors stood about me. I thought they were all the most contemptible little creatures I had ever beheld. For indeed, while I was in that prince's country, I could never endure to look in a glass after mine eyes had been accustomed to such prodigious objects, because the comparison gave me so despicable conceit of myself. The captain said that while we were at supper, he observed me to look at everything with a sort of wonder, and that I often seemed to hardly able to contain my laughter, which you know not well how to take, but imputed some disorder in my brain. I answered it was very true, and I wondered how I could forbear when I saw his dishes of the size of a silver threepence, a leg of pork hardly a mouthful, a cup not so big as a nutshell. And so I went on describing the rest of his household stuff and provisions, after the same manner. For although the queen had ordered a little equipage of all things necessary for me while I was in her service, yet my ideas were wholly taken up with what I saw on every side of me, and I winked at my own littleness, as people do at their own faults. The captain understood my raillery very well, and merely replied with the old English proverb that he doubted mine eyes were bigger than my belly, for he did not observe my stomach so good. Although I had fasted all day, and, continuing in his mirth, protested he would have gladly given £100 to see my closet in the Eagle's Bill, and afterwards in its fall from so great a height into the sea, which would certainly have been a most astonishing object, worthy to have the description of it transmitted to future ages. And the comparison of a phaeton was so obvious that he could not forbear applying it, although I did not much admire the conceit. The captain, having been at Tonquin, was in his return to England driven north-eastward to the latitude of 44 degrees and longitude of 143. But meeting a trade wind 2 days after I came on board him, we sailed southward a long time, and coasting New Holland, kept our course west-southwest, and then south-southwest, till we doubled the Cape of Good Hope. Our voyage was very prosperous, but I shall not trouble the reader with a journal of it. The captain called in at one or two ports and sent his longboat for provisions and fresh water. But I never went out of the ship until we came to the Downs, in which, on the 3rd day of June, 1706, about 9 months after my escape, I offered to leave my goods in security for payment of my freight, but the captain protested. He would not receive one farthing. We took a kind leave of each other, and I made him promise he would come see me at my house in Redriff. I hired a horse and guide for 5 shillings, which I borrowed off the captain. As I was on the road, observing the littleness of the houses, the trees, the cattle, and the people, I began to think myself in Lilliput. I was afraid of trampling on every traveller I met, and often called aloud to have them stand out of the way, so that I had like to have gotten one or two broken heads for my impertinence. When I came to mine own house, for which I was forced to inquire, one of the servants opening the door, I bent down to go in, like a goose under a gate, for fear of striking my head. My wife ran out to embrace me, but I stooped lower than her knees, thinking she could otherwise never be able to reach my mouth. My daughter kneeled to ask my blessing, but I could not see her till she arose, having been so long used to stand with my head and mine eyes erect to above 60 feet. and then I went to take her up with one hand by the waist. I looked down upon the servants and one or two friends who were in the house, as if they had been pygmies and I a giant. I told my wife she has been too thrifty, for I found she had starved herself and her daughter to nothing. In short, I behaved myself so unaccountably they were all of the captain's opinion when he first saw me, and concluded I had lost my wits. This I mention as an instance of the great power of habit and prejudice. In a little time I and my family and friends came to a right understanding, but my wife protested that I should never go to sea any more, although my evil destiny so ordered that she had not the power to hinder me. As the reader may know hereafter, in the meantime I here conclude the second part of my unfortunate voyages. End of chapter 8. Read by David Russell. For Lit to Go. Available on the web at fcit.usf.edu.